Mr. Real Life Preacher, you're my first evangelist in the blogosphere. What are you doing out here, and how do you find this space? I'm wondering, really, can you explain the blogosphere and what's happening out there any better than the techies or the political and media junkies can?
Well, I don't know. First, though, I'd like to be really clear that I don't consider myself to be doing evangelism in the blogosphere. I think one of the things that makes the blogosphere so wonderful is people seem to feel comfortable reaching across worldviews and sharing who they are without a sense of having to change someone or argue somebody out of a position. Now, that's not true all over the place, but I think it's one of the nice things about the blog world, the sharing of ideas. So I'm telling my stories and letting them have whatever effect they have on people. I don't have a real agenda for anyone to become a Christian, for example.
No, but you're teaching and you're witnessing in your own way. I didn't mean to throw a loaded word at you.
It's probably just loaded to me being from the South in the Bible Belt more than it is in other places. So maybe evangelism broadly defined would be nice, just the sharing of who you are and telling your stories. And if anyone wants to know more about Christianity, I'm certainly love to talk to anybody about it, but
Let's just talk about the blogosphere for a moment. I mean, we shouldn't be surprised, I suppose, that preaching turns up in this space. It turns up everywhere, radio, television, as well as churches and every kind of print form. But what is this blog space for you?
Well, I actually began this blog because I was becoming burned out with preaching. The art and the craft, the calling of preaching is to stand before a community of people with a contract of some kind to be faithful to a certain way of reading the scriptures, and I do that all the time. There's so many constraints, though. Everything I say, you worry at least or wonder how people are going to receive it. There's a certain diplomacy that has to come into play. Mm. I started Real Life Preacher because I just wanted to write without worrying about how people were going to receive it. And the reason I called it Real Life Preacher, believe it or not, is because I had become fascinated by this very interesting blog called True Porn Clerk Stories, which was really popular for a while. It was a woman who worked in a porn shop, and she was just telling what it was like to work in there. And that's not a part of my life that I'm, you know, that's not something I can really be involved in. I don't go to porn shops and things, so I was fascinated, as a lot of people were, and I thought, well, maybe people would want to know what a preacher's life was like, with the same kind of voyeuristic curiosity, you know, what goes on over here. So I started this thing and called a Real Life Preacher because I'm a minister in a church, but I just wanted to write and not worry about how people were going to receive it. I didn't see it as a ministry at all.
Really?
No, I know, and
I notice you've kept your anonymity about it, and I will too. But you're a teller of stories, and a lot of the ones I read that generate so many interesting comments are kind of readings of gospel moments. What was happening with Jesus when the woman confronted him and said, thank God for the breast that nursed you, and the apostles didn't know what to do. You have them kind of snickering and writing her off. But I mean, you're spelling out stories from the New Testament.
Well, what happened was, I lost control of the blog. I started it in the early going. I just told about my life and things that happened. But I wrote things that were important to me. But I began to get a response from people, and they began to say, what a neat ministry you've started. One person in particular was Christopher Key, the guy that does Barbaric Yop, which is a salon blog. He wrote and said, you know, this is a ministry. You've started a new ministry. And I said, no, I haven't. And he said, well, as I understand it, that's really not in your control. And so over time, the character Real Life Preacher, who's a little different from me as a person, I mean, I've tried, all the stories I tell are true. I don't have the time to try to make up stories. It's just easier to tell real things that happen to you. But this person, Real Life Preacher, this character, became important to people. I have I have several thousand emails I've received since December. And what are you going to do when someone writes you or sends an email and says, you know, that meant something to me, or what you wrote touched my heart, or I never read the Bible that way before? Well, it changes you. So I think you're right. I think over time, Real Life Preacher has become a kind of virtual congregation. But it did so with me being very reluctant, and I was drug along, you know, kicking and screaming. The last thing I felt I wanted was to have another ministry, you know.
Go back to the beginning, if you would,
okay.
Preacher. I mean, to the sort of confessional, what am I doing here kind of tone of your blog. What was the story about yourself that you wanted to tell? I mean, there was something about your own disbelief in belief and your skepticism that you wanted to get off your chest, I think.
Well, yes. There's no way I could exaggerate just how much of a whim it was when I began Real Life Preacher. I saw these blogs. I said, people can do this. You can just start this thing and start writing. So I just launched it very much on a whim. And, you know, I did like a lot of people do. You sit in front of the keyboard and you start writing, and what comes out is something of a surprise to me as well. So I never sat down and said, now first I'll start out with this story and then I'll move to tell my story. I mean, and I still don't do that. I have no idea what I'll write the very next time. But I did, I think I had a need to process my own story. And I'm not sure that I had ever, I'm going to take that back. I definitely had never done it before. I had not sat down and thought about what it was like to grow up in a very devout Baptist home in El Paso, Texas. And my mom and dad were devout Christian people who spent a lot of time going across to New Mexico. So I saw a lot of suffering at a very early age and carried around a lot of terrible feelings of shame. I think I would say shame, not guilt, almost a sense of shame that two worlds could live so close to each other, and shame that I wasn't doing more about it. And then my own personal skepticism and difficulty in believing the stories of the Bible, that was a very difficult thing when I was a young boy. And that just came out, Chris. I sat down one day, I started writing, I started telling my story, but I'll tell you this, nothing I've written has had as much attention as that story. I still get emails monthly, maybe two or three a month, of someone who just found the weblog, and they want to tell me, thank you for telling your story. Thank you for saying that a person can have doubts, and that's okay within the Christian tradition. I'm surprised that more people don't realize that doubt does not mean that you can't have faith.
The core of that story involves your own ministry in a hospital and your work with a woman who was sort of doing a final needle point.
Yes.
Maybe you ought to just tell it.
Well, I call her Jenny, and that's not her real name, but it's a name very much like hers. She was young, in her 30s, and I was just out of seminary. I guess I was 27 years old, and it was an internship kind of a program called Clinical Pastoral Education. And it's, I mean, when you show up at the door of the hospital, they put the badge chaplain on you and send you out into the halls. And it wasn't very long before I met her, and I had already been having a lot of struggles with my own sense of belief or lack of belief. But my goodness, I was already out of seminary. You know, once you get far enough along the line of preparation for the ministry, you know, it becomes ever more painful to consider, you know, what it might mean if you didn't believe in God anymore. But I was already having a lot of those struggles. And yes, yeah, she was a wonderful woman, and she was so sweet and absolutely dying of cancer. She was trying to finish a needle point, and I agreed to pray with her. And she didn't even pray that she would live. She just prayed that God would give her the strength to finish this thing. She wanted to have something. She left her two small children. And if you read the story, you know that she didn't make it. She died, and she died very painfully, too. I came around the corner and stood there and watched as she coded. And there was a lot of convulsing and a lot of screaming, and it was just a terrible scene altogether. And then I noticed that her needlepoint was laying on the ground, and that was that moment that maybe a lot of people have where everything seems to cave in and fall apart, and I admitted to myself, I don't really believe in a God, at least not in any kind of a God that's personal in the sense that Christian people worship God. Lots of people believe in God, like beings. Maybe a being created, but just isn't involved. I just kind of wasn't able to believe anymore in a God that was personal, or that would answer prayer. Because certainly this was a prayer that could have been answered pretty easily, just strength for a day or two. I think a lot of people have disillusioning moments like that. But what to me the redemptive part of the story is, it's rather compressed to the story, but it was first of all, I just kept on. I just put the chaplain's badge on and came back the next day. You know, there are people in hospital rooms, and whatever I believe or don't believe, they believe, and they want someone to come and pray with them and hold hands, and there was meaning in that. So I think the first step to recovery of my faith was just to come back the next day, and the day stretched into months and weeks, and I had time to work this out, and I discovered that faith is about being faithful, and that if you commit your body to serving God and to doing good in the world, then eventually the question of belief is going to become less and less important, and you won't have any trouble with that. But anyway, I don't know. I do get a lot of email about that thing I wrote, and again, I didn't have any plans about it. I didn't intend to do anything. I just sat down and wrote it. It's just something that happened to me.
Well, you write awfully well. You know, let me just say, I'm interested in spirit in general, and I'm fascinated always by the language of spirit, as long as it's not too mawkish or too literal, as long as it sort of breathes with mystery and humility about it. I mean, I think that's really what I love deepest down about Ralph Waldo Emerson, whom I call a god for bloggers. And I also should say that having done a lot of smart talk radio, I feel that spirit, hunger for spiritual language, was the kind of unmentionable core of many, many conversations we had on the radio about other things, nominally. But I'm fascinated by the comments on your blog, which testify to me, again, to just how deeply all of us yearn for the language of the invisible, the mysterious, the unresolvable. So I'm fascinated sort of by what you're learning in this whole game.
Well, I don't think I had formulated this in my mind quite as well as you just said it, but I would say that what I discovered for myself in the launching and the maintaining of the blog that's called Real Life Preacher is exactly that we share, most humans, no, I'm going to go ahead and say all humans. All humans share some kind of a strange and wonderful attraction to mystery, and I express that for myself through the classic spiritual path of Christianity, and I'm quite happy to do so and very committed to that path. My doubts about that are kind of behind me. In a lot of ways, I'm not going to stray from this path. But I like the comments that come from people who are not Christians.
So
I get a lot of Christian people who leave comments, and some of them actually irritate me at times. But I have some wonderful friends in the blog world who leave comments all the time, and that's it. We've found common ground, and that the common ground is not through a specific doctrine, but I think you're exactly right, through a kind of larger mystery or willingness to be vulnerable, intellectually vulnerable, to admit I don't know everything, and I think maybe even to admit that on some dark nights, you know, most of our hearts beat faster at the thought that there might be something out there that is larger than us, that might even care for us. And I love email from people who say, you know, well, I'm an atheist and I'm not going to be a Christian, but thank you for pointing to that little piece of mystery. I like that. Those things mean a lot to me too. And I don't know what this means in a larger sense. Maybe it's just time that people enjoy this common ground that we have as humans.
I know what you're talking about. One of my favorite atheists believes that there is no God except Johann Sebastian Bach. but I analogize a lot of the whole conversation to music. I mean, a lot of people who don't know they believe in God or are even interested in the question love music for the same reasons, that it is impalpable, it is invisible, it is deeply mysterious, enormously powerful in its effect on us, all kinds of music. But, you know, all the cliches apply. I mean, there is a harmony, there is a counterpoint in music that expresses, I don't know, it bears the mystery.
And people hear it, and they say, that is good. Now
exactly. Amen.
That sense of goodness is to me even more powerful than cultures all across the world pointing to some higher being. It's a sense that we have that we share with everyone. You come around the corner, you see someone harming a child, and you have a visceral, deep reaction. This is evil I've encountered. And apart from the poor individuals in our human community who are sociopaths or unable to share in that common sense of good, I mean, it's remarkable to me how much we share that. And
yeah.
That sense of goodness and our hearts sing at the same tunes, it's pretty wonderful, this common ground we have.
Can I just say, there's another piece of this with respect to the blogosphere and the Internet that intrigues me, and that is the Catholic Jesuit theologian Teilhard de Chardin.
Yes.
40 years ago, I read a book of his in which he really forecast the whole Internet, the blogosphere in a certain way. He called it the noosphere, N-O-O-S-phere. Noos meaning the life of the mind, really. But he kind of forecast the next step of intellectual evolution would be this kind of, should we say, world market in ideas, consciousness, humming all the day round, sort of like the market in dollars and yen, except it's ideas and it's human conversation and consciousness.
Did he call it the Omega Point we were moving toward?
I think that was somebody else, although he might have had Omega Point in it, but the main word that I've stuck with was noosphere,
mm-hmm.
from the Greek. And I wonder if that's occurred to you. I mean, that this is a kind of zone of spiritual evolution that we have staggered into and are trying to make sense of.
Okay, Chris. Yes, it did occur to me, but it was such a grandiose idea that I've chose not to talk about it up until now. When here's what I thought. Now you must remember that I live in Texas, and I grew up as a Baptist. I live in the Bible Belt, and religion, particularly Southern evangelical kind of Christianity, is just so much a part of our culture down here. There's churches on every corner, and everybody has the. It's all about doctrine. You know, what are your God words? Put them on paper. Let me compare them to mine, and let's fight about them. And then if we have a deep enough argument, we'll just split and make two different churches.
Right.
This is what folks do around here. And then there's this deep evangel. Well, let's get back to that very first comment you made. You know, when you said something about evangelism, you know, I had a kind of visceral reaction against that, because down here in the Bible Belt, evangelism means let's go door to door and try to win people to Christ. Let's just go drag people if we can, compel them to come into the church. I've actually heard people use that phrase. And I wondered if what we might be seeing with the blog world and with the Internet in general is a giving up of that need. Now, doctrinally, that's very difficult for Christian people, because they, you know, they've got some pretty strong ideas about who God is and how a person becomes right with God. I did wonder if we weren't seeing a movement toward abandoning some of that and embracing our common ground as a way of saying, maybe it doesn't matter exactly what your God words are. Maybe what really matters is, you know, are you willing to serve? Are you willing to give your life to make a difference in the world in the service of something higher than yourself?
Hmm.
But again, anytime someone says, maybe we're on the front edge of some big revolution, I always think you doom the revolution, perhaps, by thinking about it too much. Most of them seem to happen very naturally. Secondly, it seemed kind of grandiose, but I did think about that. I know where you're coming from, I think.
I want to hear more about your reaction to your readers. A lot of them say, you know, they're crying as they write their comments and that they're very much moved by your writing, which is always interesting. But what are you learning from them?
I'm learning that, and I'm sad or maybe a little embarrassed to say that this is a lesson I needed to learn, but I'm learning that it's not just Christian people who are nice and kind and gentle and loving in the world, for a lot of people that's a stunning thing for someone to say. But again, when you grow up enmeshed in a cultural Christianity, again in the Bible Belt, you can come away with this idea that there are the people who worship God and seek after God and try to do good in the world, and And admittedly, many Christian people don't do those things, but there are those people. And then there's the people out in the world who are, you know, seeking just to feed their stomachs and to go about life to, in some kind of a crass way. I mean, that's a terrible generalization, but I think when you grow up as a little boy in a Baptist church in Texas, it's a part of you. It's been wonderful to me to get comments and to read folks who I see are good people. And who want good things and think deep thoughts and have a devotion about God as they describe God that to me rivals anything I could say. That's touching to me and wonderful. The other thing that's been really nice is the emails that I get, which I've never shared with anyone, but the real stuff comes through email. I've helped people with weddings. A woman wrote me an email and said, my fiancé has passed away unexpectedly. He was a Christian. I'm not. Could you help me with some Bible verses? And she wanted to read Bible verses in honor of her beloved who had passed away because she knew that he would like them, even though she was not a believer. So I helped her get a copy of Eugene Peterson's The Message, which is a great paraphrase of the New Testament in a real modern language. Showed her some verses, and then she wrote me back after the funeral. That was just wonderful to me. I couldn't even tell you how great that made me feel.
This is so interesting, and thank you. I this is a dimension that, as I say, the techies and the all kind of media wise guys out on the blogosphere don't talk about, but it's real. And I thank you for spelling out some of it.
Well, thank you, Chris. I appreciate getting a chance to talk to you.
Keep doing what you're doing. Thank you.
Okay.
We'll talk again.
Peace, brother.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.